Hi, I'm Anthony Brabazon.
And I'm Paul Caffrey.
And this is the God Talk programme for the next half hour on 90.3 Near FM, where we will be grappling with the big questions of life from a biblical perspective.
Our text number during the programme is 087-69-44-500, and we'd love to hear from you. You can also email on nearfmgodtalk@gmail.com and get us on Twitter at nearfmgodtalk.
And greetings go out today to listeners and supporters. There's Eddie, there's Colin and Joyce. They're down in Wicklow, I think, aren't they?
That's right, Ashford.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Desi and Janie, Chris, Dave, Anton, Spencer, Nancy, Ron Mullins, and Gabe Rabison, who's recovering from a hip op. You heard about music, hip op, haven't you? Well, this is a different hip op. It's an operation on the hip. Yep. And all the best to you, Gay. I know you're doing great and you're going to get all the way there. And also Billy Jago, not to forget him. And also our podcast staff we want to thank at Near FM. That's Donny and Paul. And if you want to access any of our previous episodes, you can go to nearfm.ie, the podcast section, and you'll get us there. So I also want to thank Andy for the last 2 hours of music. That guy knows his stuff, I have to say, Paul.
He sure is, yeah.
And when he says he's going to be on the decks, that doesn't mean he's going to be plastered and on the floor. It means he's going to be playing music, I gather. So anyway, a pleasure to meet you, Andy. And you know what? We've got something slightly different today. And I have to say, we have all these sections in the God Talk. We've got the vault, and we've got our roving reporter, and we've got the hot seat, and we've got the spring,
and the spring,
of course,
which we haven't done for a while.
Which might happen today.
No, I don't think so. I'm going to keep this conversation going as long as I can.
Right,
so
to keep
the spring at bay.
Okay, well, you know, we got a new one today, and I have to say, we can inaugurate it today. And it's called, you ready for this? 90.3 Near FM, The book review.
Very good.
So here's our first one. And it's a book with an extraordinary title.
Okay.
The book is called A Nearly Infallible History of the Reformation, commemorating 500 years of popes, Protestants, reformers, radicals and other assorted irritants. Written by a guy called Nick Page. And the timing of this now is really amazing because tomorrow, isn't it?
That's right, tomorrow.
Something happened in Europe 500 years ago to the day.
Yes,
tomorrow.
31st of October, 1517 is usually regarded as the starting point, the kickoff of the Protestant Reformation or the Reformation.
Well,
now, the historians... what happened? Well, many of our listeners will have learned at school that on that famous day, a monk or a friar, to be more correct, whose name was Martin Luther, nailed 95 theses to the door of the church, the Castle Church in Wittenberg in Germany.
On one piece of paper, he'd 95 points.
95 points, actually in Latin, and not for the general public, but for disputation among theologians.
Right.
And but they got translated into German, the language of the people. Printing had been discovered not all that long before, and it was the new technology of the day.
Was it normal in that day to nail things to doors?
Yeah, that was how, if you wanted to have a theological discussion or a philosophical or a discussion among scholars, they didn't have nice bulletin boards in canteens and staff rooms. They had no Twitter. They didn't have Facebook pages. So if you wanted to get a discussion going, you just wrote it all out and you hammered it up on a door where people were sure to see it, where they couldn't miss it. And that was what he was about. So that's our friend Martin Luther. This is a great book. And a friend of mine, Paul O'Higgins, whom we'll be interviewing, I think, next week. I was chatting to Paul last week and he said, you know, great book to read, this Nearly Infallible History of the Reformation by Nick Page. So I downloaded it and started reading. And the thing I like about it, though, it's tells about the things that happened as a result of Luther and Calvin and all the other guys who collectively we refer to as the reformers or the Protestant reformers. But it's not hagiography. The book doesn't make them out to be great heroes all the time. It shows the human side.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read something from Nick Page's introduction, which I really like. He says, talking of abuse, there are sections in this book which are not for those of nervous disposition.
All
so
right.
Be warned, listeners.
Yep.
Some bits, I'm sorry to say, are quite rude and sweary. In my defence, it's not me doing the swearing for once, but people like Luther and, well, just Luther, actually. During the past five centuries, a great many myths grew up around people such as Luther, Calvin and others, not least the idea that they were nice. We like our heroes heroic and our villains villainous, particularly in Victorian times, but still a little today. Biographies of Luther portray the principled man who stood alone against hatred and villainy while rather ignoring the potty-mouthed, anti-Semitic, abusive man with his bowel problems and his uncanny ability to fall out with virtually anyone. They praise the austere, philosophical, disciplined Calvin, the writer of beautiful prose, rather than the man who engineered his opponent's exile and even death, who could not bear to be contradicted, who was so unpopular in his own city that its inhabitants tried to empty their chamber pots onto him.
Oh dear.
We get the humanist Zwingli, who systematically preached the New Testament and radically transformed the nature of Christian worship, rather than the man who drowned his enemies in the river. Some of their deeds were glorious, some of their deeds were appalling. There is more than enough moral ambiguity in this tale to go around.
My goodness. Yeah.
That will whet your appetite, I think.
Certainly would. I mean, history, obviously, it tends to airbrush a whole load of stuff and put forward a guy either in a very positive or negative light. But people are more colourful than that.
That's right.
The mixture of
and
both.
As the good book says, there is none perfect. No, not one.
And was Martin Luther the first reformer as such?
Well, he wasn't. He gets a lot of credit because he kind of kick-started this particular movement, which it caught on for a whole variety of reasons. But there were people before him who protested against some of the abuses and the neglect. For example, there was Wycliffe in England who was ended up being executed.
That's
and
right.
Then there was Jan Hus in what we would now call the Czech Republic. Wycliffe was 1320 to 1384. Jan Hus, Czech, was the following century. Well, actually later the same century, died 1415. And they hated him so much after his death, they dug him up a few years later and burnt what was left of him.
Oh, right.
So these were hard times. And if you were on the wrong side of the divide in those days, well, burning at the stake was probably what you would expect, you know.
Right, yeah. And what do we mean by the word reformation? Because just someone who's never heard this before,
to reform means to improve. I mean, if things are gone bad or things are gone off the rails, you try and bring them back. They were pretty bad. Yeah, there was all sorts of things.
And was there a spark that kind of got Luther going? Was there something that kind of went up his nose particularly?
There was the whole thing of the what we call the sale of indulgences, but there was also a personal crisis, and as often happens in all of these situations, very often the personal, almost psychological, spiritual crisis coincided with an external one. So to go back a bit, I mean, Luther ended up as a friar. He was an Augustinian friar. The story is that he was caught in a thunderstorm and he made a vow that if he got out of the thunderstorm alive, if he wasn't struck dead by lightning, he'd give his life to God as a monk. And so he joined a friary, and things didn't go all that well for him because he was what we would call nowadays an extremely scrupulous person, and he did everything that he possibly could.
He would have kind of had the hair shirt and all.
The hair shirt, the works. In fact, Nick Page says, the more I sweated, quoting Luther, the less peace and quiet I experienced.
Right.
He couldn't feel acceptable to God, no matter how hard he prayed, how thoroughly he confessed. This increasingly sweaty friar struggled to feel clean. He certainly made an effort. He was an Olympic standard confessor, sometimes exhausting his poor superior by spending 6 hours listening to his sins. Then he'd exit the confessional and then he'd realise he'd forgotten to tell some sin back in again and so on. So his superior said, we'd better do something with this guy. So there were two things. First of all, they got his mind busy. They gave him a lecturing job. He was a doctor of theology.
Right.
So they got him lecturing, and over a period of years he preached or lectured to his students on the book of Psalms, the book of Romans, the book of Galatians, the book of Hebrews. And so that got him into the scriptures. And around the same time, they said...
Was it the habit of the Augustinians, you said he was?
Yeah, he was an Augustinian.
Was it of their habit to study the Word of God or not?
Some of them would, because around this time, it was the movement called the Renaissance, which was a kind of a rebirth of classical literature. And people were rediscovering the Greek and Roman, Greek and Latin writers. And also, they were looking back into the scriptures. So a man called Erasmus, for example, published and printed a Greek version of the New Testament. So people were able... to start reading for themselves. And the slogan of the time was ad fontes, which means to the sources, back to the sources. And so Luther was certainly not the only one. There were lots around that time doing the same thing, going back to the scriptures to see. And then as soon as they began to do that, as they looked around them, they realized that things weren't quite, weren't quite as rosy as they should be. In other words, that they realized that there was a need for reform. And that's where the word reformation comes from.
Well, going back to the source is so important, because I remember listening to a guy speak years ago, and he had four bottles of water with him as he was giving his message, and one was real murky water and one was less so, and the last bottle was clear water. And he said he'd taken samples of water from the River Dodder, and the first sample he'd taken was down in Ringsend, the next one was up on Ballsbridge, and the last one, which was all clear, he went up to the Wicklow Mountains and he got a clear water from the same river. And his point was very simple. It was that if you get back to the source, things are pure. But over time, they can become contaminated. And I think the history of Christianity can be very much like that.
Certainly.
That over time, the religiosity and the rules of man and the Pharisaical rules all just muddy up the water. There's truth there, but it's mixed up.
And as I say, he was not the first one. Because even you take someone like Francis of Assisi, who was earlier than him, or you take the great Italian poet Dante, for example, they were all looking very, very critically at church and state and all that was going on. They were reading their Bibles and making these kind of comparisons. But for a variety of historical reasons, Luther's particular action 500 years ago tomorrow was really, I suppose, the match that set the fire really going.
Wow.
And then from that, there was kind of knock on, to mix our metaphors, there was a domino effect throughout Europe. People like Zwingli, Calvin, and then it came to England and so on, and Scotland.
And tell me this, Paul, what were the 95 theses, the thing that got nailed to the
door? Okay. It's funny, I mean, Luther, the last thing he was setting out to do was to start a new church or to start a radical movement. There was a thing called indulgences were being sold. So what are indulgences?
Yeah, what are they?
Okay. Well, you need to backtrack even a little bit further. The idea was, but somebody went, somebody goes, so I go and confess my sins and the priest gives me forgiveness of sins and he says, now for your penance say or do such and such to try and make up in some way for the harm that my sin has done.
Yeah.
And so people had all sorts of good works that they were told to do that, and there was a temporal punishment due to sin and they had kind of had to work that off.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Pope and the theologians of the time, they had this theory that whereas you and I might be in debt, we would have a debit balance. Okay,
right. Yeah.
That Jesus and his mother and the saints had a huge credit balance, and that the church had all this like a huge big treasury of good works, and that they could say, there's Anthony Brabazon, he's short a bit, let's give him the equivalent of 100 days hard labour as a personal kind of a credit.
Yeah.
So that was the idea of the indulgence, and not only could it be applied to the living, but you could apply it to the dead.
You mean if your mother died,
and she was suffering in purgatory to make up, you know, you could say, I'll get her an indulgence.
Wow.
And so, and you could do various good works. And because one of the good works, of course, might be to build a hospital or something like that. And then the Pope was, Leo X was the Pope at the time.
He was building
St. Peter's in Rome. Yeah. And you know, it's a funny thing.
Been there, it's a huge building.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went to Versailles in France and I saw the luxury and the opulence. I said, now I understand the French Revolution. And the first time I saw St. Peter's, I mean, it just gobsmacks you, the size and the scale, no matter how many times you've seen pictures of it.
Yeah.
And you see that and you say, now I understand the Reformation.
Yes.
So the Pope had this very clever idea. Let's sell indulgences. And if somebody wants to give 10 euro, 100 euro, whatever, for the rebuilding of St. Peter's, we'll give them an indulgence.
Right.
And so there was this man called Tetzel went around Germany selling. They kind of franchised out the sale of indulgences. And so the local prince who happened to need some money, he could get a certain share of it as well. So here am I, Tetzel, going around selling indulgences and you give me your 10 euro and I give 2 euro to the king, keep a couple of euro for myself and the rest goes to Rome for the building of St. Peter's.
And back in the day, wasn't death more prevalent, you know, like plagues and a short lifespan and all this stuff? So people are more acutely aware of their eternal matters.
What they really wanted was they wanted the shortcut. They wanted their last breath here to be their first breath in heaven, rather than to have to spend 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years in purgatory. So indulgences were something important. And the slogan, which they say, that they could just drop the as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs, was kind of the slogan. So you just drop your coin in and the next thing your soul gets out. Now, this was all generalization and so on.
Yeah,
but then, so you see, what the thing was that Luther was a very serious-minded man, and so he was a preacher and he was a teacher and he had congregation that he was responsible for, and he said, you know, this just isn't good enough because this is giving people the idea that they can just keep on sinning and they can buy their way out of sin without ever really repenting or ever changing their heart attitude to God. And so his 95 theses were objections to the sale of indulgences, not so much to indulgences themselves. And for example, one of them was, he said, well, if the Pope can empty purgatory, why doesn't he do it all out of love, not for the sake of miserable money to build a church? So he says, if the Pope is this huge treasury, well, why not just empty purgatory? That was one of the theses. As another one was, the Pope was a very wealthy man. He was of the Medici family. He was the son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, hugely wealthy. And Luther said, well, why not just build St. Peter's with his own money? He has plenty of it, you see, his
why
private wealth.
Why exploit the poor? Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, he puts up these theses, and of course, he intended them just for theological disputation. They get translated into German, and because of the printing press, these little pamphlets and tracts go all over the place,
but
and he
the
becomes
printing
notorious.
Press was pretty new in the day, wasn't it?
It was quite new, yeah. Probably.
I suppose the timing really is why, with all these reformers, probably why
exactly.
Martin Luther was so significant.
Exactly. I mean, it was very easy to get ideas around.
It's like it went viral, or
it went viral,
say.
As we would say nowadays. It was just like putting something up on Twitter or Facebook, and the other 10,000
hits.
Yeah, the other thing
hits.
You see that there were political issues involved because the German princes were fed up of all this money going to Rome, and the Pope, after all, apart from being a cleric and the head of the church, was also a very wealthy politician and a prince and so on. So there was money going into his estates and to build palaces and all that kind of stuff. So in some ways, it suited the princes there. Frederick was Luther's own, the Elector of Saxony. It kind of suited him in some ways to defend Luther and not to hand him over to Rome, because if he'd been sent to Rome, he would have been burnt to the stake. I mean, it's quite a long story. We'd be here a long time to discuss it all in detail. But do read Nick Page's book, and he talks about that.
And how do you think, Paul, just to kind of fast forward now to today, you know, how do you think all this matters to us today? You know, what's obviously Luther wasn't a perfect guy. We know he was very anti-Semitic later on and this, that and the other. We don't have to get into that, but we know he's not perfect. But what is it? What's the essence of the message of the Reformation that might matter to us today?
Well, one of the things that happened, Luther was just really preoccupied with the sense of his own guilt. And because he was reading the scriptures and he realized that this buying of indulgences was not, he just knew God enough to know that God couldn't be just bought off. And so he began to think, he was reading, as I said, he was teaching through Romans, and there's a famous verse in Romans. I'll just read a little bit from Nick Page's book. He says, for a long time, Luther had been meditating on a verse in Romans where it says that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous by faith will live by faith. Romans chapter 1. And he says that phrase, the righteousness of God, he had always interpreted as meaning God's just punishment for sinners. Okay, so this is Luther reading it. But that summoned up images of his own father all over again, a judgmental, angry, punishing God. For Luther, you couldn't love a God like that. You could only cower in terror before him. And he says, though I lived as a monk without reproach, I felt that I was a sinner before God with an extremely disturbed conscience. I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners. But he felt instinctively there must be a way through. Christ, he knew, had made satisfaction for the sins of the whole world. So this is really the crux. So I said there was, so there were political, there were ecclesiastical, but there was a deeply personal issue. So he made this incredible discovery. And how did that benefit individual believers? And I'll just read this little piece from Luther himself speaking here. He says, at last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of the words, namely, in it the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous lives by a gift of God, namely by faith. And this is the meaning. The righteousness of God is revealed by the gospel, namely the passive righteousness which the merciful God gives us by justifies us by faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. So that was his personal discovery. He realized that the righteousness was that Christ paid the penalty for sin, and that God gave this righteousness is kind of a legal declaration of not guilty.
Yeah, it's a kind of a, just to make a shorter word out of that, the goodness, you know.
The goodness,
I think the Word of God talks about two goodnesses, the one that comes from heaven, comes from God, and the other is the one we stir up ourselves.
Exactly.
And really, I suppose the key message I'm hearing out of this is that Luther was pointing out that it's the one that comes from heaven is the one that works.
Exactly.
And the one that comes from ourselves will never be good enough.
Yeah, and so this kind of lifted this load of guilt from him. And in fact, he said, I felt I was altogether born again and I had entered paradise itself through open gates. Yeah. And so then when he went into all these disputations, it's a long, long story, but the justification by faith and then the authority of Scripture were the two key rediscoveries, and all sorts of other things came. Yeah. He translated the Bible into the language of the people, wanted to have a Bible in every home. The liturgy was going to be in the language of the people. He wrote lots of hymns, for example, some of them people we still sing today, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and so on. Right, sure. All the music of Bach, for example, was the next generation of Lutheran, so it was Lutheran texts that were set to music by Bach and so on.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And did the Catholic Church ever forgive Luther?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that question. I came across something fascinating on the web. You know that the present Pope talks a lot about the mercy of God and the grace of God.
Right, Pope Francis.
Francis. And the preacher to the papal household is a man called Father Raniero Cantalamessa, a wonderful name. Cantalamessa means sing the mass, but apparently his Good Friday sermon to the audience that included the Pope last year, Pope, Cardinal, Bishops, and here's what he said. This is the Pope's personal preacher. He says, there is a danger that people can hear about the righteousness of God but not understand its meaning, so instead of being encouraged, they're frightened. St. Augustine had already clearly explained its meaning centuries ago. The righteousness of God is that by which we are made righteous, just as the salvation of God means the way that God saves us. Luther deserves credit. Now, this is in the Vatican.
Yeah.
Luther deserves credit for bringing this truth back when its meaning had been lost over the centuries, at least in Christian preaching. And it is this above all for which Christianity is indebted to the Reformation, whose fifth centenary occurs next year.
A remarkable statement.
Yeah. So really the Pope's personal preacher was actually saying we owe a debt to Luther for recovering this truth of justification by faith. And he says the reformer later wrote that when he discovered this, I felt that I was altogether born again and had entered paradise itself through open gates.
Wow.
So that was preached in the Vatican to the Pope and others last Easter time of last year.
Well, I think that's quite a remarkable piece you're after digging up. Gosh, you have your spies everywhere, Paul, don't you?
Well, you need to read the book, so I really recommend Nick Page's book. A wonderful book.
Yeah. Well, look, we're coming close to the end of our programme, but we're going to end with the prayer, and the prayer is out of Jesus' prayer book.
And it's the psalm, and it's Psalm 32, which is really a psalm about justification by faith.
Hmm.
Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the one against whom the Lord counts no iniquity and in whose spirit there is no deceit. For when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all the day. Day and night your hand was heavy upon me, my strength was dried up. I acknowledge my sin to you. I did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly offer prayers to you at a time when you may be found.